It's a real pleasure to be here, and I want to thank the ITI for its wonderful hospitality. And the hospitality is really complete. It's not just, you know, Dr. Christian. It goes all the way down to you students, who I have seen being so helpful for this Congress, for this symposium. So all of you have joined in and supported it, and I would like to say you're all part of that hospitality for which we feel so grateful. And I think I'll give my wife, Timmy, the first word.
Well, good evening. So Paul and I met in the fall of 1968 at the first faculty meeting I ever attended at New York University, which is a very, very secular university, very secular institution in the heart of New York's Greenwich Village. It was just after I had arrived at NYU. I was 26, he was 32. I was a newly hired professor in the French department. Paul was in psychology. He'd already been at NYU for a couple of years before I arrived. We were both atheists at the time, both from sort of wishy-washy Protestant backgrounds. I was a fairly staunch atheist for reasons to which I will return. And he was a sort of more casual and indifferent atheist. We got engaged in the spring of 1969. I knew somehow that I was supposed to marry Paul Vitz, though what that meant I had no idea. In fact, when I had moved to New York, which is a very big city, as you know, from New Haven, where I'd been a graduate student at Yale, I almost moved into the building that he lived in. Talk about God making it clear what he has in mind. Sort of obvious. So we got married in the summer of 1969. It was a very, what we call, late 1960s wedding. I wore a white lace mini dress with bright green slip and bright green stockings and green shoes. My children, none of my daughters have wanted, I mean, many daughters want to wear their mother's wedding dress. Nobody has wanted to wear it. They wanted to wear it to parties, but not to get married in. So we wrote our own vows. We found a Protestant minister who was willing to marry us without any reference to God. Talk about an amazing thing right there. I mean, why would you ask a Protestant minister to marry you anyway if you didn't want to mention God? Never mind. We've often joked about the fact that although God was not invited to our wedding, he came anyway. We wanted children, but we were not in any big hurry. You were atheists. But in 1979, our first daughter, Rebecca, was born, and I'll pass the baton to Paul a little bit here.
All right, it's 19. Rebecca has just been born. And, you know, Timmy brings her back from the hospital, and you realize, you know, I'm a father. That was my wake-up call. More than even getting married, somehow or other, for a man to become a father was a wake-up call. And the question arose, you know, you don't send a baby back to the store because it wasn't the model you wanted. She was perfect, and I loved her, but who was I? As her father, what was I going to stand for? In what way could I give her something? And so I began looking for what you might call a worldview. What worldview within the framework of which I would live and pass on as a father, values and understanding and knowledge about the world. But it was a real wake-up call because I was totally unprepared for this. I was a very secular, somewhat clueless young man, found a delightful lady who was from the same part of the country as I, and it was clear I was supposed to marry her, to me too, although I was a little nervous. I won't go into that, but husbands tend to be nervous because of all sorts of things, anyway. And so I looked around. This is 1971, 72. I looked around for a worldview that I could pass on to my daughter and presumably there might be another child. You know, maybe one more. And there were not many choices for worldview then. I believe there are even fewer now. The four choices I had were: you could become a radical liberal political type. You could make your worldview, still then, even you could be vaguely a communist or something like that. Well, I'd seen a lot of those people up close. I won't go into it during my graduate years and some of my first years at New York. And none of those people impressed me as persons, and the idea didn't appeal to me, the various concepts, partly maybe just because I wasn't a politically oriented person. And another worldview that was very clearly present at the time was what I would call Eastern religion. Or at the time, it was the early stages of what sometimes is called New Age spirituality. And having come from California at Stanford, and where I was a graduate student and got my doctorate, I knew something about the early stages of that world. And to me, the New Age, Eastern, whatever spirituality, was a kind of tourist religion. You know, tourists go around and they pick a little bit of Hinduism and a little bit of Buddhism and a little bit of this, and they put it all together, and then it stays meaningful for 4 or 5 years, and then it morphs into something else that's more narcissistically supportive. And so I knew that wasn't for me. And then I thought, well, maybe I should continue to have the worldview that I had at the time. And that worldview was atheist, skeptical. You know, evolution has brought us into this world and it's all a material thing. And meanwhile, you grab all the gusto you can, to quote some advertisement, and it's all about success. It's all about personal getting. It's all about me. Well, I had already come to the conclusion, and I'm not quite sure why, that anyone who's all focused on themselves to the exclusion of others as the source of being was suffering. He was such a person was worshiping, if you will, half an illusion and half a fool. So I knew that wasn't where the answer was. And I intuitively understood that to find an answer for my life, for my marriage, and for my children, I had to back away from that focus on the isolated self and, you know, what I later, when I published, called self-worship. And that all that left for me was traditional religion. So I was backed into a corner. And I looked in that corner and I saw Christianity. Oh, gosh. That seemed to me to be so dumb and outdated or whatever. But then, every now and then, I would read in the New York media a quote. It would just be a little quote someday from either the Pope and sometimes from an evangelical Protestant like Billy Graham. And I would read this quote and I would read it and think about it and I'd say, you know, that is true, but I can't believe it. Now that's a very interesting position for someone who's committed to the mind and intellectual knowledge to be in. This was something I could believe was true, but I couldn't truly believe it. That is, I knew it was true, but I couldn't believe it in any meaningful way. My heart was too far removed from what my mind could actually understand. Well, a few years later, maybe a year or so, I decided, and by the way, I was undermined she didn't quite know this. Timmy was very interested in the Middle Ages, in the medieval.
I'm a medievalist.
She's a medievalist.
Not surprising.
And in 1970, before we had had any child, as a kind of second honeymoon, we went to France and traveled around in France. And this is a dangerous thing for people like atheists to do. We went, surprisingly, we were drawn to many of the beautiful cathedrals in France and the religious architecture and places. So we, chip on the shoulder, but hey, there's something here, And so in I think about 1971 in January or maybe a little bit later, one weekend when I didn't know what to do because Timmy had left with our daughter, Rebecca, and gone to visit her mother. And so I didn't know quite what to do. I said, I think I'll go up and visit. There's a very medieval-looking Anglo-Catholic Episcopal church in the center of Manhattan called St. Thomas. And I went up there, embarrassed that I was leaving in their elevator because it was I wore a tie and jacket. It was Sunday morning. We were in a New York University apartment building. Everybody sleeps late, and so I'm going out. Oh, it looks like this guy's going to church. Anyway, so I went out, and somehow or other, something resonated in my heart about it. And when Timmy came back, I told her, almost as a confession, but I told her. And she said, I'd like to go too. And that was the beginning of our spiritual journey. We didn't know where we were going. But about that spiritual journey now, your turn.
Well, we haven't really talked about our conversion, but we'll all That's we can a... say for the moment is that 10 years after we'd gotten married in this wacky Protestant, or not yet, non-Protestant service, we were both Catholics with four children. So we can talk about our conversion later if you want. So anyway, within a few more years, we had six children. Now, I think Paul is quite taken aback by this. As a colleague of mine said at NYU, you got started in a very yuppie way. You all know what yuppies are, right? You white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. So you got started in a very yuppie way, but you continued in a very non-yuppie way. So we had six children. I continued to teach at NYU. I'm a medievalist, as I said, in the French department. I'm still at it. Fortunately, academic jobs are very flexible in terms of the time spent in any particular place, any office or classroom. We lived also about 10 minutes on foot from our offices, and were able to walk the children to school every day and pick them up every day. And I was able to get home by mid-afternoon most days. So combining a family, even an increasingly large family, with my career was for some reason, just never very hard for me. I'm sure my colleagues thought I was insane, but they mostly didn't say it out loud. I kind of joke about at what point, secular people, at what point they realize you're crazy. I can't decide whether it's your third child or your fourth child, but with a fourth, they think, don't even bother to talk about this person. With this person, she's really off her rocker. So, and it was also, I will say, not so hard to be a Catholic medievalist, because in the Middle Ages, it's got nothing but Catholics, except for a few heretics, which we decided. But so it was not so hard to be a Catholic medievalist. I think it was much harder for Paul to be increasingly a Catholic psychologist. That's a different kind of discipline. I mean, medievalists, when I go to the big medieval conference every May in Kalamazoo, Michigan, they have a 7 a.m. mass that all the Catholics go to. This is not so tough. Being a Catholic...
Psychology conventions never begin with a 7 o'clock mass.
So this is, I pass the ball to you.
Okay. Well, here, I had one of the more painful things I had to do. I felt I had to do it. I didn't really have to do it, but I felt I had to do. Is I had been trained and hired and gotten tenure. God was wise; He didn't intervene until I had tenure.
That means when they can't get rid of you, just so you know.
Yeah. And so,
when it's hard for them to get rid of you.
Very hard. And so I'd been trained as a cognitive, experimental, somewhat, in some ways as a mathematical psychologist. And that's all, it has nothing to do with, you know, today it's morphed into neuroscience and artificial intelligence, okay? But at the time, that's what I had been. And was. And my whole career getting up to that point had been that. And I had to let go. Somehow or other, I felt I had to let go of it. And I turned to psychology and the faith and how they could deal with each other. And the first stuff I wrote was very critical of much of secular, particularly psychotherapy and its theorists. So this meant I had to let go of all of that and go off on a pilgrimage. I'm talking now intellectually. I didn't know where it was going. Who ever heard of a Catholic, much less, I mean, who ever heard of a Christian psychologist in 1975? Nobody had. Vaguely, eventually I found one or two, whatever, and slowly wasn't such a problem. And the second thing is, I'll say this, like all fathers, I wondered, how could I support this growing family? Where could I find... You know, I'm going to lose favor with my department. I'm going to lose favor with raises and financial support. They're not going to, even if they keep me on because they can't fire me without some other kind of cause, they're not going to give me raises. And, of course, they didn't. And I said, oh, how can I survive? God provided the money in other ways. All of a sudden, people would ask me to talk. And at the time, I must admit, the people who responded to me most positively were evangelical Protestants and not Catholics. And they supported me and invited me to talk. And all of a sudden, I got $500 for a talk back in the 70s. That was big money, or moderately big money. And so it made up. So God gave me exactly, once I plotted the trajectory in a secular sense, that I would actually have gotten as a salary. And then I saw my actual salary. And the difference was what God gave me. He took care. God took care of my worry. And that's something to keep in mind. Now, the other thing that God was telling me at this time, through my family, through my wife and my children, God was giving me what I would call lessons in love. And I have to admit that I was pretty clueless about relationships and about love. I didn't know much about it. I had sort of vague romantic notions. I'd grown up in a family where there were, my siblings were all boys, so you don't know anything about women. Or you really don't. And my mother was very nice and kind, but not requiring that we respond to her needs. And by the way, one of the things women should do with their mothers is sometimes...
With their children.
Should make them honor them as part of their natural obligation and response. My mother didn't do that. And so I was rather clueless. I was also, in part, one of my problems was, some of you in psychology will know what attachment anxiety is, and about attachment theory. Well, there are people who seem to have very secure attachment. Fortunately, that's normally most of them, or the majority. But there are two kinds of attachment anxiety. One is called sort of ambivalent or preoccupied. These are the people who are always wondering where you are when they're in a relationship. That was not me. The other is dismissive. And I suffered from dismissive attachment anxiety. I didn't want to count on anybody. My mother hadn't been there enough for me, not for any sinful reasons on her part. I won't go into that. But she had lots of issues of her own, including the fact that she married a man who already had five children, and she had to deal with five stepchildren, and her own mother hadn't been very good. And all of a sudden, after me comes two or three other siblings. So I wasn't adequately attached to my mother. And this made me dismissive of other people and of attachment and of love and relationship. And what I learned from Timmy through her attachment to me and also through her attachment to her children, I learned about love. It's an odd thing to say, but we have to learn love. And there are millions of people in the world today growing up in much more dysfunctional families than I ever did. The Middle East is filled with them who have to learn about love. And various ways I learned. I think I learned moderately more about love from my daughters than I did from my sons, although I learned a different kind of about love from my sons. And I remember one incident, which I'll tell you about. With my daughter, Jessica. She was about three and a half, okay? I walk into the apartment. By the way, we raised our children, all six of them, on the 23rd floor of a very small apartment in Greenwich Village. So I walk in, and I'm in a crabby mood. A crabby mood. We all have days like that, whatever it is. And I walked in, and we didn't have a dog, so I couldn't kick the dog. So I saw little Jessica out in front of me a few feet, and I shouted at her and said, "Oh, get out of the way," or something. You know, I did something. And Jessica had a big surprise on her face. Started and began crying and sobbing and ran off to her room. Okay. Uh-oh. So I walk in a little bit further and I look over to my right. And there's dear Timmy. And she's looking at me. Now, she didn't say anything.
Too tight.
That's right. Very wise. She didn't say anything. But she looked at me in an expression that all husbands hate. It was the expression of, "You really blew it, you know." And I knew that. So I went around, walking in the living room, walking around, you know, and I said, "You know, I shouldn't have done that. Jessica did nothing to me. She had no responsibility for my terrible, you know, punishing comments about her, you know." And I said, "Oh," and then I said, "Look, you're the father." And I said, "Look, a general does not apologize to a private." Do you understand what I'm talking about? We're talking about vertical authority. And I walked around a little bit more. A little bit more, and I said, "Yeah, I know, but, you know, you should apologize because there was no justification for it." I walked around a little more. And it's possible the Holy Spirit finally went, bang, you know. Anyway, so I went back, I walked back to Jessica, and she was in her room on her bed crying. She heard me coming and cried a little harder. And I sat down next to her. And I patted her, and I said to her, "Look, honey, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have been like that. It wasn't right. I didn't really mean it. I was just feeling very bad from work at the office." And she turned around and says, and gave me a big hug and said, "Oh, Daddy, I know all about feelings." And let me explain, though. I mean, this really happened. You know, some minutes later, we had dinner. And the difference was amazing. Because, you know, if I had not done that, the dinner would have been further looks from my wife, sniffling and pathetic behavior from Jessica, and a kind of distant, awkward very unsatisfactory dinner. But instead, everything had been healed. And I learned that one of the things that fathers have to understand is that to confess their weaknesses honestly is not to destroy their authority. It is to make the possibility of mistakes capable of being healing and retrieved. That it's not about that. It's not about the general talking to the private. And of course, our Lord is a major representation of that to men. But anyway, so what I learned about love was from my children and from my wife. When I would see her and her enormous capacity to love our children, and I would wonder, how could anybody do this? Children are a pain. That is, I'm just saying, you know, they take a lot of time. They're not, you know, what do they give you? And I saw her love and her self-giving to her children, and it was an enormous message to me. And of course, you know, she did the same thing to me. Irresistible. Okay.
So we were married and Catholics with lots of children. We hardly had any Catholic friends. We didn't know any Catholics. That wasn't our background. Our backgrounds are kind of wishy-washy Protestants. Certainly not in the university world. Blessedly, we knew some wonderful priests, and they were very important to us and to our children. They came for dinner on a regular basis. We went to see them. We had a family confessor that we went to see often. One of the great blessings of my life as a Catholic mother was getting to know a really wonderful priest who encouraged me to say the rosary daily with my children. Now, I was kind of a Protestant, you know. I mean, I thought the kids would hate it and would refuse, but lo and behold, they got totally into it. Our son Daniel, who is now a priest, said to me once when he was about 10 years old, no matter where I am and what I am doing, I'm always saying the rosary in my heart. Amazing! You know, this is, it was a total surprise to me. Now, starting early on, we learned a lot about God from our children. I should explain that I think in many ways, our original conversions were what they call conversions of the brain, not of the heart. We converted, I mean, we haven't talked about our conversion, but we both converted for very largely intellectual reasons. Paul, you can tell me if I'm wrong, but don't tell me too fast. Paul had a kind of allergic reaction to psychology. I really came to believe that Catholicism was true, but they were very intellectual conversions. But our children grew up Catholic in a way in which we had not, which was an enormous blessing for them. So there's a saying, insanity is inherited, you get it from your children. And it's completely true, but it's also true that we parents learn a whole lot about God from our children. And I had this experience very early on. One day when our son Peter was about 5, he said to me, I need a prayer corner. I said, what is a prayer corner? Did you read about this in a book? I said, no, I just need a prayer corner. Well, we had, you know, 6 children in a 3-bedroom apartment in Manhattan, sort of like a submarine in the air, prayer corner. But, you know, we found a little corner of the living room. We made him a little prayer corner with a little desk, and he, you know, put holy images in it. And he used to go there on a regular basis to pray, unreminded by his mother. You know, these are children who can hardly learn to, you know, you have to remind them to say please and thank you. But he could go to his prayer corner 2 or 3 times a day and pray. I mean, this is just amazing to me. I mean, I think one of the issues for parents, and I mean, speaking of ourselves, is that we tend to think of ourselves as the middleman. We're explaining God to our children, and they will learn about God from us. And to some degree, that's true, but it's also true that children learn a lot about God straight from God. They don't have to have us as the middlemen all the time. It was really quite an amazing thing. So things were going along pretty well. By this time, Paul and I were both daily communicants. We were kind of staggering along as best we could as Catholics. But we had some real problems. Though I didn't really recognize them as such. It's taken me a long time to get glued into this. Paul, as you may or may not quite realize, Paul was very concerned about his career at NYU. He couldn't, it was increasingly a bad place for him to be. He couldn't accomplish what he wanted to accomplish. He worked late at his office many nights and part of the day on Saturdays and Sundays. And he was very frustrated. I mean, he'd made this conversion, but, you know, he'd been a secular psychologist, so now what the heck was he going to do? So it was very hard on him. As I said, being a Catholic medievalist, whatever, it doesn't matter. You know, become a Catholic and a medievalist, who can even notice the difference? but it was a big deal for a psychologist. So it meant that he was working late nights, he wasn't there on Saturday and Sunday much of the day, which meant that he wasn't around very much for the children, and he found family life also wearing. He was also a more solitary person than I am. As he said, he had to learn some things about loving and about being part of family. But he's, you know, people, there are people for whom family life is harder. I mean, thinking about, you like peace and quiet and you have six children? Good luck with that. Good luck with that. So, now one reason why this was all particularly hard for us was, had to do with my father. You talked about his father. Your mother. So my father was in many respects a very admirable man, but he was also, I know, quiet and depressed and not very available to me, you might say, not very present to me as a child. And then when I was 16, he killed himself. He shot himself in our home. Big deal. Really big deal. I came to realize it was a big deal. So the major reason, at least the conscious reason for my atheism, was that I was very angry with God over my father's death. God should not have allowed this to happen. This was wrong of God to let this happen. In any case, I increasingly felt, again, unconsciously, abandoned, as I had been abandoned by my father. I felt abandoned by Paul. He was too busy with his work. He was too busy with his office. He was not there for me and for our children. He was pleasant and interesting. We always had a nice relationship in one sense. But I was alone with my children as my mother had been left alone with her children. So in an important sense, Paul and I had become estranged, and this was a problem. Now, God came to our rescue, to my rescue, but also to our rescue in a very strange way. God, as we know, acts in very strange ways. If you don't know this yet, you will. So, as I say, I've been angry with God for many years over my father's death. But never angry with my father. I was angry with God. And I thought I was fine about my father and his death and so forth. But one fall, for reasons which I spare you, it's a long story and I won't go into that, I discovered my father's death. I mean, psychologically, I discovered my father's death. And I discovered my deep, deep anger at my father for having died, for having killed himself and for having died, and for having, you know, been unavailable to me. It was like having a volcano go off inside. It was incredibly dramatic. Extremely interesting. Whoa, this is really interesting. But it was also very painful, like waking up from a coma to terrible pain. I mean, it was really the most dramatic psychological. I've been a pretty mellow person, and this was an amazing psychological experience. So, whoa. So, as it happens, I was married to a psychologist. So Paul and I talked about this a whole lot. He was very, very helpful as I sorted out all these complicated feelings that I had never known existed, you know. When I realized how angry I was at my father and how carefully I had hidden from myself for decades the degree of my anger and disappointment at my father, I said to Paul one day, it's not all baloney. That is psychology. I'd always thought the psychology was baloney. I married him because he was an academic psychologist. He was not a touchy-feely psychological psychologist. You know what I'm saying? But all of a sudden I realized, whoa, I mean, this is really real. You know, this is really about psychology. And I said, it's not all baloney. So it was extraordinarily useful to me and helpful to me to have a husband who was a psychologist and who was able to help me figure out what all this was about. Because I say it was the most dramatic psychological experience of my life. And I have to say it was unbelievably painful. It was a very, very good thing. It was like being, as I say, it was like having been in a coma for many years. I'm a very task, as my children and my husband would tell you, but don't ask him yet, I'm a very task-oriented person. I have a certain tendency to be sort of like a machine. I want to get it done. I do my job. It kind of, to realize that this had broken my heart in some way was very humanizing. It was a very important, it was not just painful, it was very positive. It was a very positive experience for me. In any case, it was very helpful to have a husband who understood all this. There's another odd way in which God brought us together, brought us closer together. About 15 years ago, Paul had to have some minor surgery. Now, it was supposed to be a nothing operation. And the day before, Paul and I had we hardly ever argued. We had a real argument over, like, a couch we were buying or a lamp. I forget, something really stupid, right? We were hardly speaking. It was supposed to be, in and out surgery, so I hardly went with him to the surgery. I thought, well, maybe I ought to go, whatever. So I went with the surgeon, he went to the operation. I waited, and I waited, and I waited, and after a while, the doctor came out and said, he almost died. Whoa! If I had let my husband die, if my husband had died after something so stupid and we hadn't been speaking, imagine how I would have felt, it was something so ridiculous, in the large scheme of things, so preposterous that we weren't speaking over, as I say, let's take it, a lamp that we were buying. And I thought, talk about the expression, don't let the sun go down on your wrath. I shudder whenever I think about what it would have been like if my husband had died during the surgery and I hadn't been speaking to him, I think it's your turn.
Well, we're sort of, we're more or less up to the last few years. And since then, there's been a whole new phase. It's not the first phase was six children. The next phase was children who were getting married and going to graduate school and, all involved in what we would call early adulthood. And we're mostly through that phase, and we're now into a third phase, which is the phase of being grandparents.
Actually, I'll take that one again, because I realized there's something I forgot to say. So we now live outside of Washington, D.C., and in Arlington, Virginia. We're blessed that we have six children who all live close to us, and they're all miraculously admirable Catholic men and women, a huge blessing. We continue to learn things from our faith and about our faith and Catholicism from them. Let me just give you two examples. We have a daughter, Jessica, that Paul referred to earlier, who has a PhD in medieval studies from Princeton, but who's now homeschooling seven children. She decided that she wasn't going to do that. She homeschools seven children, and she's really quite a phenomenon. We also have a son who's a priest who has been through a very stressful year and a half, and we have been through it with him. In the fall of 2014, sort of out of the blue, he discovered that he had a huge brain tumor at the size of a tennis ball in his right frontal lobe. He's been through three brain surgeries, a major infection, radiation treatment. He's now blessedly fine, completely himself, working hard as a priest and as a chaplain and at various places. But the most important and impressive thing, and the greatest thing, is that all along he's been cheerful. This happened just after he was ordained to the priesthood, three months after he was ordained. Completely cheerful and at peace about all this. One of our daughters, our youngest daughter, does calligraphy. And the piece of calligraphy I had her do was, Lord, let this cup pass. And the one that he had her do was, my heart is ready. They felt sort of like a loser, My heart is ready, Lord, my heart is ready. But he's been completely cheerful, at peace, a tremendous, as we would say in the secular world, an incredible good sport. But, just completely at peace about this, with this tumor and his surgeries and painful treatments and all the hard things that come with having a brain tumor. So we now have 18 grandchildren. We're expecting our 19th in June. We don't want to be piggy, but we're hoping to have even more grandchildren. We have one son who's not married yet, and we have a daughter who's just getting rolling as a mother. So we're hoping to have even more. We have a great deal of fun with the grandchildren who are already around and find them high in entertainment value and also full of constant, sometimes moving and sometimes very humorous reminders of God's love. So I'll pass it back to you.
So I guess I would say, looking back on it, there's still a wonderful adventure ahead. But there was a kind of triple miracle in it, which was that I converted and became a Catholic, that my lovely wife converted, I call her my child bride, she converted and became a Catholic, and that we did this together.
It was amazing. We became Catholics at the same time for very different reasons.
And we were kind of a Catholic tag team. I would make a step forward and then sort of get lazy or frozen, and then she'd pull me forward, and then she'd stop for a while, then we'd both, you know, so forth. And there were important Catholics along the way who helped us. Not so much Catholic families, which we would have been very happy to have been connected with, but they were mostly priests. Some of them you might know who were very important in our life. Most you won't know. They were local holy priests. You might know Father Benedict Groeschel. He was very important for us. He got in touch with us, and he was my sponsor when I came into the church. Another priest with a very up-and-down reputation, particularly with the Jesuits. He was a Jesuit, but was very unpopular with them, named Malachy Martin. He was very important for us. And then some holy priests that you probably wouldn't know, Father Halligan and Monsignor Caban. And they came to our house and talked to our children. And, you know, this Father Daniel, who was the priest who was had the brain tumor, you know, he was our sort of macho son. Bounced around Europe for a year and a half and came back and did this, then joined the Navy for 4 years and did a tour in Iraq. And finally he comes back and he finds his priesthood in D.C. in the Basilica of the, in the Crypt Church of the Basilica. But he was the boy who at age 10 had said, "I'm always saying the rosary in my heart." And so now we don't know what will come, but it's been a wonderful adventure. We look back on it with great gratitude and thankfulness. One of the things we're grateful for and show, I hope, gratitude for is the ITI and you people who are here. And what will happen in the future, God knows.
It's all an adventure.
But it is an adventure. The most surprising things can happen. None of the things that I had sort of planned, which would have been sort of, oh, I'll go into academia, be a typical secular academia. Maybe we'll get married and have one, maybe two children. It'll be all very comfortable. We'll have enough money and we won't do anything very remarkable, but enjoy ourselves. We learned how to enjoy others. At least that was the major message for me. And it was my wife and our children who taught me that lesson on how to enjoy loving others.
Okay.